Accession number 15331, Reel 1.
Mr. Newham, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
In Hull.
Which year was this?
In 1918.
What did your father do for a living?
He worked for the British Rail, which then was the London North Eastern Railway, finally ending up as a permanent way inspector.
Did you go to school in Hull?
Oh, yes.
Whereabouts?
Middleton Street School, originally, where I started in the infant classes. And then I went to the Brunswick Avenue Central School, which was a type of higher grade school through scholarship. And then I went in for another bursary-attached scholarship for the Boulevard Nautical School, which I went to when I was 13 and a half. Yes, 13, roughly. And I left there when I was 15 and went to sea.
What kind of things did you learn at the Nautical College, Nautical School?
All sorts, everything connected with the sea. Navigation, signalling, seamanship. Besides having the normal subjects of an ordinary school like English, geography, history and so on. But the main subjects, of course, prime subjects, were nautical, fitting you out for being a good seaman.
Was it a good education in your estimation?
Yes, I think it was. I had very good results from the point of view that my other schools, I didn't do all that wonderfully well. But at nautical school, I shone.
What was the quality of the teachers there?
Wonderful, wonderful. And I think it was a more of a friendly atmosphere pervaded, which you were not scared of the teachers. You could speak to them, you could talk to them, you could even have a boxing match with them if you wanted to. And they were just wonderful. I can't praise nautical school teachings higher, you know.
What had given you the idea that you should go to sea?
Well, I was unhappy at the school I was at. I was unhappy at the Brunswick Avenue School because I didn't seem to be making the educational headway I would like to have done. I always seemed to be dragging behind. There were the normal subjects, you know, English, history, French, arts. I never seemed to make a lot of headway. But then when I got out of that environment into the new environment of the sea, which was a different atmosphere altogether than nautical school, because it doesn't exist now, it's closed down. But I found that I had the best environment of all for education there. In fact, I got my school reports out to show you, just as a matter of interest.
We can look at them afterwards, but probably best if we look at them later. So you went to sea, first of all, in 1934, did you?
1934, in February 28, 1934.
And which line did you serve with, first of all?
The Prince Line. I was an indentured cadet, apprentice, to the Prince Line.
Where were they registered?
London.
And what kind of a line were they to serve with in the mid-30s?
Well, better than some, but not as good as others. A lot of shipping companies had very bad reputations in those days of poor feeding, poor accommodation and that sort of thing. But the Prince Line, I thought, was better than some of them. And there were others, of course, like P&O, that's absolutely first class. But then, on the other hand, some of the ships in the Prince Line were better than the others. And what I refer to there is the ship I eventually ended up with was the Cingalese Prince, which was a cargo passenger ship on round-the-world cruises, New York to New York, which was most interesting. I did several trips. Nearly 3 years on that ship, going round the world continually. And the interesting part about that was, you know, that in those days, sea travel was so cheap. You probably may have heard of the pound-a-day ship. You could pay a pound a day and go on a ship as a crew, like Mediterranean cruise, 14 days, £14. We had around the world 3 months, £120. Of course, you wouldn't get it for that now, about 12,000 maybe, but not £120. But that's about the price that it was. In fact, that ship that I served my apprenticeship on, a book was written about it called The Cinghalese Prince, and it was written by Brooks Atkinson, who was a critic for the New York Times. He was a theatre critic for them, but he did a around-the-world voyage with us, and he wrote the book. And I've got that book. I had a terrible job getting it, but I got it through writing to New York, and eventually the stepson of the author got in touch with me, and he and I are now very firm friends. We write to each other very regularly. In fact, they've been here to see us. We met them in Madeira for a holiday. We met his wife in Oxford for a holiday. I don't know if they'll ever come again or whether we'll ever get there, but we have an open invitation to go if we wish to.
I think you told me earlier that in 1938 you decided to get out of the merchant service.
Well, the thing was that my ambition, having had all this experience of the sea, and I could see that there was a lot better things at sea than what I had, my ambition was to be master of a large passenger liner, eventually. So that was my ambition when I got home, was to sit for my certificates and then progress to where my ambition was. But unfortunately, when I got home, and I went to the Trinity House College, Captain Lazenby said, well, before you start straining your eyes studying, go and get your eyesight tested at the Board of Trade. I got my eyesight tested and failed, and I'm absolutely devastated. So at that point I decided I didn't want to know the sea any longer. So I gave up the sea, and I took a job as a waste paper clerk at the Hull Daily Mail, selling all the old rubbish paper at a very, very low wage to try and get myself going again. And I took correspondence courses, I went to night classes, I took bookkeeping accountancy, I took shorthand and typing. And of course, when the war broke out in 1939, I hadn't had long enough time to be efficient in any of these things. So what I did, I continued with my correspondence course while I was at sea. But the unfortunate part about what that was, the censor used to cut my results up in such a state, blue pencil, one thing or another, I couldn't find out whether I was making any progress or not. So I gave up. I was with the Sheffield College, Sheffield College that was doing a correspondence course. I gave that up. That was that. The end of the war came, and I thought, well, where do I go from here? I can't go back to sea. Although the ship I was on, the supernumeraries, said to me, if you wish to, we'll keep you on as long as we're here. But he said, we can't guarantee anything. So I said, well, in that case, I'll do the same as everybody else. I'll take my demob when I get home and finish and go back to where I was. And I came back from being mate of a tanker, a coastal tanker, to selling waste paper again, Hull Daily Mail. And from then on, I progressed with them. I made every effort to improve myself. I didn't have a lot of time to go to school. In fact, there weren't a lot of courses like there are now to do. I could have done some, I suppose. But just by a dint of effort and saying, I'll do this, I'll do that, and doing as I was told, which is mainly what you have to do, I got improvement and eventually became the circulation manager.
Let me go back to the beginning of the war, though. Did you hear Neville Chamberlain's broadcast?
I did. My father, my brother, myself, and my mother were all listening to the radio when he came back and said we're at war with Germany, Britain's at war with Germany. And we were so devastated.
Had you not expected it?
Yes. Yes. I didn't think there was any other answer, because these despots have to be stopped, no matter where they are. And I thought, well, I don't want to go back to sea again. And I went with everybody else to register with my group, my age group, letters, you know, my name numbers and all the rest of it, at the Labour Exchange, and they said, "You're a seaman." I said, "Yes, I am." "I was," I said, "but I'm not any longer." "Ah, but you have entered into the shipping pool." "Oh, yes." "Well, you have to go back to sea again." And that's how I went back to sea again. I didn't want to go back to sea. So the last thing I wanted to do. But it obviously turned out the safest place for me.
What was your first ship on going back to sea?
The first ship was the ship called the Camassian. It was a United Africa Company ship. And she traded on the west coast of Africa, which really the war didn't affect so much then as it did later on. And we got back quite safely. That's the Camassian there, look. That one. And I went as an able seaman, much to my disgust. I didn't want to go as an able seaman because I'd been used to better things. And I went on several ships as able seaman because I was told to, because of the Merchant Navy Reserve, as I've told you. Where did I put it then? Did I give you it? Oh, yes, you got it over there. Merchant Navy Reserve sheet there. I'd signed to do that, so I had to carry out what I'd signed to do. And so, eventually, this went on till I'd served on the Camassiu and the Templemead, the Nil Seymour, and I think there was one other.
And the Danby?
No, the next one was the Danby, which was one of Roepner's, and they said I was going third mate of it because I was an ex-apprentice. With my sea experience and knowledge, navigation ability and all the rest of it, that I was fit enough to go as third mate. I promptly pointed out to them that I had failed my eyesight test, that I could not officially be a watchkeeping officer with bad eyesight. The master said I'd be responsible for him. So the Captain Tate was responsible for the fact that I was doing the 8 to 12 watch with him at night, because what had happened, as you probably know, by the time of this stage at 1941, which is when I went in the Danby, it was March in 1941, there'd been so many ships lost with a volume of officers and crew that were irreplaceable. They had to find people who were capable of doing the job, even without qualification or certification. They had to do that. And a lot of people don't realise that, but there's a tremendous amount of people lost. In fact, it was once said to me that in comparison with other forces, the Merchant Navy lost more people pro rata than any other force that there was. I find it hard to believe, but it's probably right. And then after being on the Danby, because each trip got more traumatic, each voyage across the Atlantic and that sort of thing, got more traumatic because you were shot by the time you got home with nerves for thinking what could have happened to you. And when you were in convoy and you saw other ships blown up, tankers on fire and ships just upending and going down stern first, and going past bodies in the water, when you got home you think, "My God, I want to get out of this." And you used to go home and have a rest, and then go on to another ship. The next ship after that, the Danby, was the Jutland, which was the one that we went to Risher on.
Just before we go on to the Jutland, if I can ask you about the earlier ships, did you get attacked in any of these early four ships?
Oh, yes, the convoys were attacked, but we were lucky. We were never hit. I had a charmed life, at least the chips I was on led a charmed life along with me. I always thought it peculiar that so many people were lost, and yet I didn't get lost. I seemed to have that. The toast that was said to me before I left home, keep your feet dry, seemed to work. You know, I had a friend who used to give me a toast before I went to sea every time. The last thing we did was keep your feet dry, and I never got my feet wet. So I think I led a charmed life.
Where did you go to on the Atlantic run, to Halifax?
Well, several, all the North American ports, mainly New York, Boston, Philadelphia, Halifax, St. John's, Newfoundland, all those North American ports. I mean, you can't really remember distinctly after all this time where every ship went at every particular point in time. It's only a generalisation of not across the to America, back home with whatever goods you could bring.
What did you think of the kind of escorts with which you were provided in those days by the Royal Navy?
Well, I think the Navy had a very difficult task because there were so many ships and they could only do so much. I think we got adequate coverage, as much as they could provide, but then they had other things to do to prevent people like the ships like the Shawnoss and the Ludlow and all those getting out. They had to have a protection of keeping them out of the area we were operating in. Even though there are enormous number of submarines in the Atlantic, enormous number of submarines, and they worked as a pack formation, attacking submarines from the stern quarters. You know, I think that the Navy did a very good job.
And when you were promoted to third mate, did it work out despite your poor eyesight?
Oh, yes, I never had any bother. I could then... I took sights at noon each day along with the other officers. I did my bearings and all the necessary things for the navigating of a ship.
And how did Rottnest and the other lines compare with the Prince's line?
Well, the Prince line was better than Rottnest. But then, really, Rottnest improves quite considerably. They became an average line, like everybody else. They're all about the same, eventually, because... During the war, as you will recall, that everyone was on rations. Ships had to be stored, and I think they're all stored pretty much the same with what could be afforded for the amount of time they presumed the ship was going to be away. But at the same time, once ships got to America, they could get stores ad lib, and they were storing more or less in America rather than in England, so you got better amount of food and stores than you would do if you'd actually take it out of the pantry of your own country, which is a good idea. You get your stocks and stores aboard abroad, and you save what your own countrymen needed at home. What, of course, you did need, of course, was fresh vegetables, which you had to get wherever you were. But the dry stores, such as sugar, tea, butter, things like that, you could get plenty of. They stocked up abroad.
Were there any convoys before you went to Russia which were particularly bad?
Well, they were getting worse as the war went on. There was a time when you left this country in convoy and got so far out into the Atlantic, and then you were considered to be in a safe zone. The danger zone ended at a particular point, and then your escorts left you, and you went on your own sweet way. You went independently to where you were bound for. But then, when you were coming home, we had to gather for convoy in such places as Newfoundland, off the coast of North America, and join up and make a convoy to come home But up to a certain point, you could go with your navigation lights on until you got to the danger zone, then it's lights out and it's in complete darkness. But eventually, towards the end of the war, of course, the danger zone extended right to the American coast and into the West Indies and those places, because submarines were getting themselves out to these areas with the motherships, supply ships, and of course they were attacking convoys and ships anywhere. And of course then you had the raiders, which were going all over the North and South Atlantic, sinking ships whether they were armed or not, with just peaceful diversion ships.
Do you think the convoys were well organised?
I think so. I think so. I think it was a marvellous idea, providing everybody did as they were supposed to do, zigzag when they were told to zigzag, obey the Commodore's signals. And I think in general terms, it was a very, very good effort on part of the Navy to organise the convoys.
What was your attitude towards the U-boat crews who were carrying out the attacks? Was there any hatred?
Well, the thing is that they were fighting for their country. We were fighting for our country. I think the hatred that people had was against the dictatorship. I think that the U-boat crews, they were sort of pictured as being worse than what they were. I think they're only human beings, the same as we were. They had a job to do, and they were delighted when they were successful. At the same time, if we had the opportunity of sinking one, we took it, didn't we? That's the whole thing. That was war, wasn't it?
Yes. Now, I interrupted you with you going to the steamship Jutland on the 13th of November 1941.
Yeah, that's right.
Can you tell me the story of your time with that ship, please?
Well, it was a bit of a traumatic time. I wasn't happy on the ship. I was third mate, and I was really made to understand that I was third mate. And I was a third mate without any certificates. And, of course, I was taken a bit of advantage of by the others. I didn't mind, I suppose, that I had to go through the war and get it over and done with, and I had to put up with it. But the interesting part about the Jutland, I mean, apart from my own personal feelings, we had a very interesting passenger who joined us, Oban Lockyer area, and went with us to Reykjavik, and he flew back from Reykjavik to London or wherever for some orders and came back again. And it turned out it was the very notable man, Group Captain Leonard Cheshire VC. He wasn't VC in those days, he was quite a young and very good-looking man. We took him to Murmansk. We found out that he was on his way to be air attaché at Kuibyshev. Very interesting, because during the war we were not allowed radio sets on ships because of oscillation and giving our positions away and that sort of thing. But I always took a gramophone with me. I've still got it, actually, the gramophone. One of those wind-up ones. A few records, and Group Captain Chess used to borrow my gramophone and records to amuse himself, because he had nothing to do, just to sit and wait till we got him to Russia. And he was so pleased that I did that. I never ever saw him afterward. I wanted to, but never saw him after we'd got to Russia. But I used to play what he used to call battleships. It's a game with dots and pieces of line drawn on a paper. I can't remember the rules of it now, but he taught me to play this battleships. And I used to sit with him for hours playing battleships.
Trying to sink each other's...
Well, no, it's a matter of making shapes. You could make a destroyer, you could make a battleship, you could make a submarine, you could make a corvette out of these dots and lines. And you were shaking a dice. to get number of dots you could use up and that sort of thing. And if you could complete something first, well, that was what somebody marks to you. Rather funny little game. But he was very amusing and he was a very nice man.
What kind of discs did you have to entertain him?
Records.
Music.
78 records, the old 78s.
But do you remember any particular pieces?
Oh, yes, I had plenty of Bing Crosby and pieces like that. One of my favourite was Bing Crosby, and I had several Bing Crosby records. And I still have the records, I still have the gramophone. I suppose it'd be an antique by now. Wind up, open, you know, portable, carrying like an ordinary attaché case.
Did you have any conversations with Cheshire? Anything that you remember that he said?
No. He was a very, very secretive man. General conversation about what was going on the ship and what we're going to have for meals and things like that, what meals we'd had. Just general conversations. There was nothing ever spoken about what his job was going to be until he'd left, and we found out later that he'd gone to be air attaché at Kuibyshev.
And he never came in contact with you again?
No. I was in the mind of writing to him because of the Cheshire Homes. And during my civilian life, I did quite a lot for charity. I thought, well, we have something in common, and I'll get in touch with him and talk to him about it, but I never did. Never mind. And of course, he's dead now, of course. He's passed on, which is very unfortunate.
What was the captain of the Joplin like?
I won't be sued for libel with this, will I?
Because, well, don't mention his name. And...
Well, he liked to battle with the demon alcohol. He liked to have a drink, and he could be rather brutal. Not a nice man.
You?
No. We had to put him in bed once or twice because he was too inebriated to do anything else. But he wasn't a nice man. Mind, we got the ship to Russia, we got the ship back home again. And then I left in Dundee.
Did you just do the one Arctic concert?
Oh, yes, that was enough for me. We had a terrible time. The temperature was so low. In actual fact, talk about Group Captain Cheshire. When he came on board, they put him in my cabin, the third mate's cabin. And I had to be moved into the ship's hospital. Now, the ship's hospital was a very cold and dank and horrible place, which I did a trip to Russia in. Very uncomfortable accommodation. And very little heat. In fact, I can tell you that the portholes, I had to chip the ice away with an axe because it was so congealed over the porthole. I couldn't look out of the porthole because of the ice. I had to break the ice away to get a sight through the porthole. So I wouldn't have gone back on that ship, whatever. You know, it was a very uncomfortable ship.
What were you carrying?
War material. We had tanks, we had lorries, we had a lot of sugar, we had a lot of general cargo. That was the really war materials we were taking, which was what Russia needed. They needed the armaments to continue their part of the war, didn't they?
Do you remember the name of the convoy?
PQ7, I think it's in that book.